From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The movie event of the week is the opening of Martin Scorsese's film The Age of Innocence. On today's Fresh Air, a talk by Martin Scorsese, recorded last June at New York University. We'll hear Scorsese talk about his films and the films that influenced him. Also on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we bring you an interview from last year with actor Harvey Keitel, in which he talked about working with Scorsese on Mean Streets and Taxi Driver. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has seen Scorsese's new film. We'll end the show with his review of The Age of Innocence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There were scattered demonstrations in the Gaza Strip today to protest the recent PLO agreement with Israel on self-rule, but there are no reports of clashes with Israeli authorities. NPR's Scott Simon reports from Gaza City.
Small demonstrations spilled out onto the streets of Gaza today. Crowds were denouncing Yasser Arafat as a traitor and the autonomy agreement as a sellout. Palestinian flags, which are still technically illegal under Israeli occupation, flapped from windows and roofs, and many of the marchers, most of them young schoolboys, threw stones, but not at Israeli soldiers. Soldiers were nowhere to be seen. Ever since last Monday's signing of the agreement between Israel and Yasser Arafat's PLO, Israeli soldiers have seemed to be mostly deliberately absent from many of the areas of Gaza they used to patrol. They're no longer breaking up demonstrations, they're no longer being struck by rocks thrown by crowds, and are therefore no longer shooting rubber bullets at rock-throwing crowds. The frequent demonstrations in Gaza are now denouncing the PLO, whose police will not arrive for several months, rather than the occupying forces of Israel. This is Scott Simon near the Gaza Strip.
All the parties to the Palestinian self-rule agreement have said that success depends on finding money to make the occupied territories economically strong. The Clinton administration is reportedly preparing a drive to raise that money. U.S. officials said today that Secretary of State Warren Christopher is expected to announce a donor conference during a speech at Columbia University on Monday. Spokesman Mike McCurry declined to confirm what an announcement will be made or that the United States would agree to host such a conference. Christopher has said in the past that most of the money needed for the occupied territories would come from other countries. Today, U.S. Army Rangers in Somalia shot and killed a man alleged to work for clan leader Mohammed Farah Aidid. The Pentagon said the man threatened members of a search team with an automatic rifle. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
75 Rangers were conducting a search mission of a Mogadishu compound suspected of being a command and control center for Aidid's militia. While helicopter gunships hovered overhead, providing cover for the Rangers, the soldiers cordoned off the compound. The Pentagon says the Rangers were not on a hunt for Aidid, but did find evidence, including communications gear, that the location was being used by Aidid as a command center. An informant, according to the Pentagon, told the Rangers that the man who was killed after confronting soldiers with an automatic weapon was a lieutenant of Aidid's and was also involved in the June 5th ambush of Pakistani peacekeepers. 24 soldiers were killed in that attack. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 18 points. This is NPR News in Washington. President Clinton said today that he's disturbed that American troops acting as UN peacekeepers in Somalia have been increasingly embroiled in the conflict, and he called for a political solution. The president spoke at a joint news conference with Italian Prime Minister Carlo Ciampi, who has strongly criticized UN military operations in Somalia. President Clinton blamed Somali clan leader Mohammed Farah Aidid for the violence in Mogadishu, which he said was part of a strategy to make the UN presence there more unpopular. Angolan rebels have wrapped up talks with American officials in the Ivory Coast. The rebels promised to declare a unilateral ceasefire next Monday to stop what the United Nations has called the world's worst conflict. Cindy Shiner of Africa News Service reports.
Delegates from the UNITA rebel movement are due to return to their base in central Angola this weekend to prepare for their ceasefire declaration. If effective, it will stop a year of fighting that has claimed more than 50,000 lives. The United Nations estimates that at least 1,000 people are dying daily in Angola. Rebels met Thursday with officials from the United States, UNITA's former Cold War ally, to help get the peace process moving again. 6 weeks of talks failed in Abidjan last May, largely due to UNITA's refusal to withdraw from territories it has seized since going back to war last October. Since May, the rebel group has faced increasing international isolation. The United Nations this week said it will impose an oil and arms embargo against UNITA unless it adheres to its ceasefire pledge. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Abidjan.
Amnesty International said today that the African nation of Zaire is sliding toward a total breakdown of law and order and blamed the situation on dictator Mobutu Sese Seko. The London-based human rights group said that Mobutu's regime has committed appalling human rights violations and may be responsible for the deaths of thousands of civilians. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Scorsese's new movie, The Age of Innocence, opened today. It's very out of character for the king of contemporary New York Italian realism to adapt an Edith Wharton novel set in 19th century New York high society. We're about to get some insights into Scorsese's character and his movies as we listen to a Q&A session with him recorded earlier in the summer at New York University, presented by their Department of Cinema Studies at the Tisch School of the Arts. The questions were asked by the department chair, William Simon. Some of those questions were submitted in writing by the audience. Scorsese's movies include Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, New York, New York, Raging Bull, The Last Temptation of Christ, King of Comedy, Goodfellas, and Cape Fear. Here's Scorsese responding to a question about how his movies have reworked film genres.
Taxi Driver was something we were talking about, film noir, the film noir made after the war, the darkness that came in to the soul of this country after World War II, and how it revealed itself in these films, films which were influenced by Germans and French, I think, German filmmakers, you know. And what we did with the Taxi, I said it should be New York Gothic. I said, you know, it's like a Gothic horror film, only it's New York, and it's a cabbie. That could be rough, you know, and understandably too, because De Niro drove a cab for a couple of nights, took a couple of weeks, and I sat in the cab with him a couple of times. It's really it's a hell of a job. I mean, God, it's awful. In terms of getting in and then a person telling you where to go, you don't know where you're going. The person behind you controls your existence for the next hour, next half hour. Anything could happen. And it's really Paul Schrader's thing, Paul Schrader's script, and his vision. But the style of it was certainly influenced by a sort of pushing forward of the film noir is what we were trying for. And then, of course, I went further with it in New York, New York, which was, again, after the war, there were American musical comedies that were made before the war in the 30s, and then, of course, in 1944, you had Vincent Minnelli do Meet Me in St. Louis, where it changed the form of the musical film, where instead of the Rodgers and Astaire pictures, where you would have the wonderful Gershwin songs, and they'd sing, and there was boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. In Meet Me in St. Louis, the songs came out of the characters and they progressed the plot and the emotions of the people. And it became part of it became a very new way of doing musicals. And after the war, however, you still had these beautiful, splashy Technicolor pictures, but some of them were kind of strange, like one called My Dream Is Yours with Doris Day and Jack Carson and Lee Bowman. And she loves Lee Bowman, but he's a cad. He wears a terrific white dinner jacket with a black belt. He looks great. And Jack Carson was the same Jack, but he's always heavy. I mean, I always liked Jack Carson because he was so likable as a character actor. He loves her, but she doesn't care for him at all. She likes Lee Bowman, who's a cad. And basically, it's these undercurrents of people in show business, of people trying to entertain, of people trying to express themselves artistically. And you had these strange undercurrents of something not being right with their personal lives. What are they trying to tell us? But they try everything. They try everything. They even have a stupid dream sequence where Jack Carson and Doris Day are dressed up as the Easter Bunny. I said, what were they thinking? They were trying to still make it a musical. Come and enjoy yourselves. In the meantime, they're punching you under the table, like, you know. It's like, that's not good, boy, you know. It's going to be a problem for her when she marries this guy, you know. That, oh, jeez. I said, what was this? What is this all about? And that's only one of them. Actually, it's a pretty good film. It's directed by Michael Curtiz in beautiful Technicolor. And then there was, well, I think you really hit the stride when you do, when you have Judy Garland, James Mason's version of, George Cukor's version of Star is Born, 1954, 55. That's the real level I thought I was trying to reach and try to revise that for the 70s in New York, New York. And what I tried to do there was to have, and this is where it comes in very clearly, the improvisatory style in the foreground and the old studio style in the background. The background, however, consisted of sets that had to be built. When you build a set, it costs money. And I didn't realize when I went out to LA to do the picture, I was living in LA for a few years, and I had the thought, it's a funny thing, of course, because I guess you're young, you think nothing fades and nothing goes away. And so I still thought that a lot of these sets existed and these negatives were fine and things like that. So I got there and I said, well, isn't that the old MGM set for the train and the beginning of the bandwagon and all that? It's falling apart. I said, yeah, that's the only thing that exists now. And there were only a few other places. And so we had to build these sets, and that cost money. So the problem was then waiting for us to get the inspiration for improvisation and adding to scenes when we had all that money being thrown into the actual production. And when in the opening of the picture, when there's an improvisation where he's trying to pick a date, have a date with Liza Minnelli in the film, we worked on that scene for 1 week with 1,000 extras each day. And that's when it started to go wrong. Because the money started to pile up. And I kept saying, yeah, but we're getting something good. And we were getting some interesting things. However, what I'm trying to say is that you had a situation where one style, the improvisatory style, is very often better controlled in a lower budget. Every time a set was built, that was the only scene that we had to shoot. In other words, you could not go somewhere else and shoot because it wasn't built. So we were improvising in this one scene, and the set was ready for us to move into the next week, but we improvised ourselves into a situation where we couldn't go to that set. And so it became a great difficult learning lesson for us, because it was a matter of controlling improvisation, controlling the improvisation to the point of literally, and you get down to basics, you sit in a room, you say, okay, now what's the picture about? And what are the scenes about? And I knew what it was about. There was a combination of these, the pushing it forward into the 70s and bringing the undercurrents that were in those films of the musicals with the strange undercurrents of personal problems and bringing that in the foreground to make it grow with what was happening in the country. But the way I went about it was not the most scientific way. And then after that, we were able to do with Raging Bull to come back and do it properly, I think, you know, in terms of improvisation.
And then we have a question here about storyboarding. And I mean, I think it's fairly well known that at a certain point that you used to storyboard in entire pictures in great detail. And I guess the question here is do you still continue to do that, and does storyboarding play a part in writing the script and so on? And I guess, I mean, if I could add one other aspect to that, since you've been talking a lot about improvisation, is that there seems to me to be a tension between, on the one hand, a great deal of pre-production planning through storyboarding, but then a major sort of use of improvisation.
What happens,
how do those relate to each
other? Happens,
for
example, I had to storyboard. I guess it goes right back to the years when I was younger, when I was just doing these little drawings in a room by myself, and I guess I have to go back to that. There's no doubt I storyboarded everything, and a lot of it has to do with storyboarding for economic reasons. Because you didn't have the money to shoot. You didn't have the money to get there and not know what you were going to do. You had to have a plan. I had to have a plan. Now, there are a lot of other people who don't do that. And, I mean, Fellini doesn't do it. And I understand Lynch does not do it either. I mean, goes and they work. Bertolucci doesn't do it. Gets there and they work it out. Benjamin Storaro, they work it out. Some of the most beautiful stuff ever filmed. It depends on the temperament. I just think that for me, everything that I imagine in my head as images that move and intercut together and to create a certain feeling, that's the way to shoot that scene. Now, the dialogue scenes sometimes do not take that same, it doesn't fall into the same law. So that, for example, you can have a scene in Goodfellas. Now, Goodfellas, the script of Goodfellas written by myself and Nick Pileggi, pretty much in the script, everything was almost like being in a storyboard. I have since after Raging Bull and King of Comedy, I've stopped doing all the pictures. I just do small pictures on the side of the script now. After Hours, I started doing that. There's lots of pictures on the sides of the script, and my director of photography, Michael Baldhouse, would transfer the pictures and Xeroxes, and then write them out and figure out what to do with them. And in terms of like how to shoot this particular one, what piece of equipment to use, et cetera. And in Goodfellas, the script was written that way so that I didn't have to do the drawings. It's almost like documentary, where at one point he robs Air France, I think it is, for some money, and he brings the money to Paulie, and Paulie says, hey, don't spend that money all in one place. You cut close-up money going down to a table. Money being picked up, check. All of that. In other words, we didn't sit in the editing room and say, oh, gee, we need a close-up of the money, you know? No, he just told him, don't spend all in one place. He's spending it. You know, it's like throwing the money. That's the idea. And so the whole script was like that. But when you get a scene that was improvised with Joe Pesci saying, what are you laughing? What do you think I'm funny? Why do you think I'm funny? Now, you can't draw. I mean, that's not drawn. But I must tell you, what that is, there's two cameras. I'm Joe, he's Ray. There's two cameras here. One this way, one this way, shooting me. And it's not a close-up. We didn't do the scene 10 times going medium, wide first, and wide, then tighter. It stayed in two frames, and the two frames are important because you have Joe, and you have guys around him, and you have Ray, and you have guys around him, and you have to see the reaction of what it does to the people in the room. You got to feel how those guys start to, you know, he's only, don't ask, he can talk for himself. You have to see that. You have to see that the mood change on everybody. Because if you go into close-ups, you may be getting like an intense thing. It becomes not truthful, I felt. And so that kind of thing, you know, you draw a picture, you say, oh, it's got to have so-and-so. We're going to have to, you know, just set up the two cameras this way so we can get them two medium shots, which goes right back to like the kind of American framing I used to love in Howard Hawks pictures. He's got like 10 people in the frame all the time. If you ever look at Red River and The Thing, look at the movie The Thing that he produced. I mean, or Only Angels Have Wings. I mean, it's amazing. But of course, at that time, there was no small screen video, so that image was projected, and you would see their faces, even though it was from below the knees up, you'd see the expression of their face. So on TV, it's a little hard now. But that kind of thinking has to go into a scene like that. Otherwise, you'd be there, and you do it in the cutting. And when you do some things in the cutting, sometimes, unfortunately, it becomes selecting, not directing. And that's a problem. Everybody falls into it. Sometimes you shoot something a certain way, and you think it's going to work this way, and then suddenly you find yourself going into the outs. She turns here. Quick, put it over here. Oh, great. Okay, that matches. Now, I mean, that happens, you know. But it's something Andre de Tott said to me. He says, a lot of people these days are becoming selectors. They put 10 cameras down, and then they go in the editing room, and it becomes, the image. That one looks good, put it this way. There's one guy who does that, though, but he's certainly a director. It's Kurosawa. They asked him, how did you shoot his battle scenes? He says, one take. I said, really? He said, 9 cameras. Sets it up all day. And these guys, and I know this, I found out the secret. We were out there in Japan, he told me, he said he has 20 horsemen. He says, he calls them his 20 horsemen. These are guys who've been with him like for 25 years. They do all the stunts in the foreground. They take care of him. They set up, they work out the shot with his nephew, Mike Inouye, who is one of the producers, and his Saito, the cameraman. They work it out, they know it, and then they call him to come from the house. It's okay. Now you can come down. And then he lays it all together, but it's a matter of getting the light in the right position. That's why he doesn't have to wait there. He's 83 years old, he's still directing.
We're listening to a talk by film director Martin Scorsese, recorded in June at New York University. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back to a talk with Martin Scorsese, recorded at New York University.
In order to make the personal films that you sometimes also need to make the commercial films, yeah. Is that still the case? Or
yeah.
The current industry, is that still a situation?
In the 70s, we tried, as I said, with Taxi Driver and Alice's Liver Anymore to make, or even Mean Streets to a certain extent. I was so glad when Warner Brothers bought it because it was the place that made the greatest gangster films. And Mean Streets has that kind of lineage, in a way. But it was not really a gangster. It was more of a personal statement. But I was interested in the 70s of making films that came out of the genre, commercial genres, and we were trying to revise them. I remember Francis Coppola yelling at me and George Lucas about, you can't revise that stuff. He said, Boxcar Bertha, you can't, don't try to change the endings the way they, he said, no, the good guy has to win this. People expect a certain kind of thing in a mythic film where you have mythic characters, they expect certain things. And you have to give it to them, you have to deliver. And George was trying to do something, it was before American Graffiti. And he said, it doesn't work when you do that sort of thing. And in some cases, he was quite right. But by the time I did Raging Bull, I didn't care what it was. I didn't care. I really thought that it was the end of my career, basically. I was going to go to Italy and make films, 16-millimeter films about saints. I thought, they all laugh at me, but that's what I was going to do. I was talking, we were doing research, and because it was really Rye Television at the time, was doing some really good films, and Bertolucci was working on television, Ermanno Olmi and Francesco Rossi, all these guys. And I was sort of inspired by the Rossellini films, and I said, well, let's just do that. And I didn't understand, you know, what was happening. I really never had a good business sense about that sort of thing. But when I did Raging Bull, I just threw it all in there and figured it would leave. I did eventually wind up moving out of California and stayed in New York in the past decade. But after that, things changed radically. And in the case, for example, of getting Last Temptation of Christ made, I had to promise I'd do a mainstream film for them. And for Universal, and it became Cape Fear, and it was as closest to a mainstream picture I could get, I thought. But the thing was, again, there are major challenges to try to deal with the thriller elements, and also a remake. You know, it's a remake. You got to be very, very careful when you deal with that kind of thing. After Hours was a picture I tried to get myself sort of back into fighting shape in a way, which was to do a film at the age of 40 that I did at the age of 30. And that is, you know, shoot 40 days, 40 nights, running around. Do it for $4.5 million all in, including his salary, which was hardly anything, and try to, at that time, because the 80s, America in the 80s, making certain kinds of films, there was the films that were like, you know, the Spielberg-Lucas things, which were so, making so much money. It was the mega hits. And here I made a picture called King of Comedy, which closed in 4 weeks, you know. So after that, I tried to do Last Temptation of Christ, and the plug was pulled about 4 weeks before we started shooting. And then I realized we couldn't get anything made that I wanted to get made. And so I came across this idea called, which became After Hours, and worked on that and did kind of a low-budget film again and tried to stay alive creatively. And then that led to fairly well, and that led to a more commercial project, again, where I was trying the same kind of thing within a more mainstream framework, and that was The Color of Money, in which we're able to do a picture with those movie stars coming in $1 million under budget. And then after that, it was a matter of literally being able to make Last Temptation of Christ, but again for a price, $7 million, all in. That's salaries for everybody and everything else. And shooting in North Africa for $7 million is not bad, but it was certainly, I'll never forget the surrounding of the temple. I had five guys from Rome, five stuntmen, and they had Roman costumes on, Roman soldier costumes, right? And I had to, there was a trouble in the temple, whatever, and they look up, they hear a sound, they look up, and Roman soldiers come up, and then Roman soldiers come up, more Roman soldiers, and more over here. Well, I had five guys. Wow. The trick was to learn, again, go back. The whole picture was storyboarded because we had no time for anything. We had no time to breathe, to get there. And by the time we got to the location, too, this was out in the desert in places, you know. And so I realized it was the old, you know, I drew the shots, and I figured, okay, I know what I have to do. But when I was doing it, I was just, oh, it was so painful. But I said, all right, this is it. Five of them come up here, flash pan. Cut, same five guys. That's it. And then they had to fight the Levite guards. And they became the Levite guards on reverses. I'm not kidding. And I said, I can't believe what we're doing. I said, this is, I mean, if I hadn't studied Roger Corman pictures, you would never be able to do this. But I mean, they were the Levite guards. I couldn't believe it. I said, for the reverse, now we got, and they were all yelling in Italian and Spanish. It was the most despairing moment. And I had just read the reviews for Empire of the Sun and The Last Emperor. From they sent Time magazine. I said, oh, beautiful, I gotta see the film. But look, they had, oh, Look at all the extras he had. Oh, oh, what have I done? I said, maybe I was just too eager to do it. Maybe I should have waited. And Michael Ball, I said, Marty, they're never going to give you that kind of extra for this picture. Let's shoot. Come on, get up. Come on, let's go. And it was hysterical. If you look at the temple scene, every shot, they're the same guys. Every now and then we change a helmet. But the tricky one was the Levites. That was...
Oh, man.
So it's that kind of thing. And I was able then, I was able after that, I was right up, what do we do after that, Thelma? Goodfellas? Oh, New York's, well, Goodfellas, the major feature. Oh, Life Lessons, yeah. And that was something that was Woody Allen's idea to do, he liked the old Italian films and French films of the early 60s, that they were a series of short stories. And that like Boccaccio 70 and pictures like that. And so he had originally talked to me, and then Francis did it. And that was something that had been worked on for a long time. That we had more leeway. We had $5 million to do that. And that was only a 40-minute film. See. And then Goodfellas. And Goodfellas was, again, one for me, in a sense. And after that, we had to do the one for them in terms of for Cape Fear. And I don't say that in terms of excusing anything. That's a certain reality. And when I get myself involved in those situations, I try to learn as much as I can from the choice that I make. And I must tell you, Cape Fear was a very hard picture to make, and it was also the first film I used widescreen, anamorphic lenses, and I learned how to work with boats, and of course, it's a very difficult thing to do, and storyboarded the entire picture, pretty much the entire, especially the boat sequence at the end. It's the first time I used a storyboard artist, but I worked with my own drawings first, and it took about 3 weeks for him to make the same kind of drawings, 200 shots, just for that sequence alone. So, you know, it became quite a job on that. And what are we doing now? Age of Innocence. Age of Innocence. I know you wanted to ask me about what Age of Innocence. Age of Innocence. Innocence is something I've been wanting to do for Jay Cox. My old friend gave me the book 10 years ago, or more than that, 1980, 13 years ago, and I read it about 7 years ago. You know, and it takes me a long time sort of gestate these things. What I'm trying these days to do is to do a lot of reading if I can, but I grew up on visual images, not books. And I mean, I saw movies and television shows and movies on TV, and there were no books in the house, really. It was the Daily News and the Daily Mirror. And I never read those, so, you know, and basically, I became exposed to visual literacy, I think. And these days, it's really fun to discover some authors and try to read the books and try to find the time to read the books, you know. In this case, Edith Wharton, The Age of Innocence. And so I wound up with, Jay gave me this book. He said, I know this is you, he said, when the time comes. And if you want to do a period piece. And so we wound up finally, I think the film was commissioned by Fox, and then it went to Columbia Pictures when we were finishing Cape Fear. And it's kind of a departure, I think, and I've tried to utilize the same film language within a period setting. And as far as the themes are concerned and things like that, I mean, I can't really talk about that now, but the idea is a picture. It's really a picture that I wanted to make for many years, and we were lucky that Columbia Pictures gave us the money and the time to finish it properly.
Martin Scorsese recorded last June at New York University. The moderator was William Simon, chair of the Department of Cinema Studies at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with actor Harvey Keitel about his roles in the early Martin Scorsese films Mean Streets and Taxi Driver. Keitel's more recent films include Bugsy, Thelma and Louise, and The Bad Lieutenant. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Scorsese's new movie, The Age of Innocence, based on the Edith Wharton novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton today called on China to step back from a plan to resume nuclear weapons testing, saying there is no reasonable threat to China from any other nuclear power. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
Administration officials say satellite information suggests China may be preparing to conduct the first underground nuclear test in nearly a year. Senior officials have urged China not to go through with this. Asked how he would respond, President Clinton said, "I don't want to cross any more bridges." A Chinese test would put the president in a difficult position. In July, Clinton extended a moratorium on U.S. testing. But in an effort to satisfy those for and against nuclear tests, he warned if another country tests, he would seek congressional authorization to resume U.S. tests. Russia, France, and Britain all promised they wouldn't be the first to test. China sent contradictory messages. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Bosnian Muslim and Croat commanders have agreed to stop fighting in south and central Bosnia. The UN brokered the ceasefire, which goes into effect tomorrow at noon local time. The officers reached agreement today as battles continued between their armies in the southern city of Mostar. Bosnia's three warring groups meet in the capital, Sarajevo, on Tuesday. Mediator David Owen expects they will sign a peace agreement. The UN Security Council said today it may reimpose sanctions against Haiti if security forces there don't halt a wave of violent attacks. The warning comes less than a month after the council voted to end sanctions, pending the return of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The council's statement was prompted by the attack last weekend in which at least a dozen people were killed during a church service. Among them was a prominent supporter of President Aristide. Speaking on behalf of the 15 council members, Venezuelan Ambassador Adolfo Tallardat called on the commander-in-chief of the Haitian Armed Forces to comply with the peace accord signed in New York earlier this year.
The council considered that it was urgent to send a strong message of support for the constitutional and democratic regime in Haiti, and also a warning to those groups which are creating a very delicate situation in the country.
The council's concern has been fueled by reports that Dante Caputo, the special UN envoy currently in Haiti, and other UN personnel have received death threats. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
About 100 protesters in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, broke up a ceremony installing the new foreign minister today. The demonstrators rushed into the ministry, screaming slogans against the United Nations. Police did nothing to stop the protests. There are no reports of casualties. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost nearly 18 points to close at 3613.25. This is NPR News. President Clinton says he hasn't finished working out the details of how to pay for his health care reforms. At a news conference today, the president said he still has another round of meetings about cost before he unveils the plan on Wednesday. There's talk of higher cigarette taxes and perhaps more taxes on hard liquor. The president has also hinted at a 1% surcharge on big companies that set up their own insurance pools. But he said today he hasn't made up his mind yet on that. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton visited a community-based health clinic in Minneapolis today. She met with patients and staff before taking part in a health care summit at the University of Minnesota. Mark Zedeklik of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Patients and staff at the Central Avenue Clinic in Minneapolis wasted no time getting to the point, firing off concerns and questions about health care reform to Hillary Rodham Clinton. The administrator told Mrs. Clinton she spends 75% of her time raising money to pay for services the clinic provides low-income patients, many of whom do not have medical insurance. The First Lady said community-based clinics will rank high among funding priorities.
What we hope will happen is that community health centers will not only continue to be funded as what we call essential providers, but that they will also be forming partnerships with other providers.
The First Lady left the Minneapolis clinic with a pile of paperwork, mostly medical assistance applications, jokingly referring to the stack as evidence the system is in need of reform. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Zedeklik in Minneapolis.
A Cuban MiG-21 fighter jet landed at Key West Naval Air Station today after the pilot apparently defected from Cuba. A Navy spokesman says the man is a captain in the Cuban Air Force. There were protests against the Israeli PLO peace accord in the Gaza Strip today. Hundreds of Palestinians marched through a refugee camp, promising to destroy the plan and increase their attacks on Israel. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When Martin Scorsese was making his first feature-length film, Who's That Knocking at My Door?, he auditioned an unknown, inexperienced young actor named Harvey Keitel. Keitel starred in that film and became a part of Scorsese's ensemble of actors. Keitel gave extraordinary performances in Scorsese's Mean Streets and Taxi Driver. As part of our weekly series of interviews from the archives, we're featuring an interview from last year with Keitel. A few days before I spoke with him, he had won the Best Supporting Actor Award from the National Society of Film Critics. The award cited his work in three films, Bugsy, Thelma and Louise, and Mortal Thoughts. More recently, he gave a startling and unsavory performance in The Bad Lieutenant. Let's start with the opening scene of Mean Streets. Keitel played Charlie, a young Italian man caught between his responsibilities to friends and family in the old neighborhood and his longing to get out, and caught between the temptations of sin and his desire for salvation.
Lord, I'm not worthy to eat your flesh, not worthy to drink your blood.
Okay, I just come out of confession, right? Right. And the priest gives me the usual penance, right? 10 Hail Marys, 10 Our Fathers, 10 whatever. Now, you know that next week I'm gonna come back and he's gonna just give me another 10 Hail Marys and another 10 Our Fathers, and I mean, you know how I feel about that shit. Those things, they don't mean anything to me. They're just words. Now, that may be okay for the others, but it just doesn't work for me. I mean, if I do something wrong, I just want to pay for it my way. So I do my own penance for my own sins. What do you say, huh?
Yeah, it's all bull except the pain, right? The pain of hell. The burn from a lighted match increased a million times.
Infinite.
No, you don't fuck around with the infinite. There's no way you do that. Pain in hell has two sides. The kind you can touch with your hand. The kind you can feel in your heart. Your soul, the spiritual side. And you know, the worst of the two is the spiritual.
When you had that first audition with Scorsese, besides auditioning for the role, did you end up talking about a lot of things and seeing how much you had in common during that first meeting?
When we met, it's like meeting a lover. And I don't mean just a man and a woman. I mean a man and a man. There's something that you recognize in each other that attracts you. And we had that feeling when we met.
When you were playing the role of Charlie in Mean Streets, I've always wondered if how much of that character came out of your own life and how much of that character came out of Scorsese's life, and if you built any of the character on watching Scorsese's mannerisms and trying to make it his story.
We shared a lot in common in terms of our growing up. When an actor creates a role in terms of characterization, that's another matter. You go to the source, the people who lived in Little Italy, and you study... behavior. And then you incorporate it, you put it onto the character. But the inner machinations of Charlie in Mean Streets and Harvey Keitel and Martin Scorsese, we shared a lot in common growing up. Our conflicts in growing up. Trying to find an identity, trying to understand what we are, who we are, what we're about, what's good and what's not good, what's right, what's not right. Our dealings with sexuality.
I've always wanted to ask you about your role in Taxi Driver as Sport, Jodie Foster's pimp. Now, I had read that in the original script, this role was really very small, and that, in fact, you were offered a larger role, but you insisted on the role of the pimp. What did you see in it and that made you want to build it into a larger role and take it yourself?
Well, first off, what you say is accurate. The reason I wanted to play the pimp was that I had lived for a number of years at that time in Hell's Kitchen in New York. And for a good 7 years or so, I had been nightly walking home, passing all the pimps and prostitutes along 9th Avenue in New York. And out of all that, taking them in all those years, there were some ideas I had about a pimp. And it interests me to play one.
What fascinated you about the pimps in the neighborhood?
Well, it's the whole idea of a man selling a woman. What is that? For me, it's such a horrible, horrible thing to deny one's soul, one's humanity, to put it into usage that way. I wanted to learn about that. I wanted to know about that. What kind of people engage in that? What is their emotional makeup, their psychological makeup?
So what did you do to find that out?
Well, if I tell you I got it solely from this pimp whom I met and worked with for 2 weeks improvising back and forth, me and him, I'd play the girl, he'd teach me about playing the pimp, and then I'd play the pimp and he'd play the girl. It wouldn't be the entire answer. A lot of it came from my own conflict about women, my own vulnerability about my own sexuality, my own not knowing, my own having questions about my own sexuality and about the sexuality of women.
What kind of conflict were you going through?
Well, this notion that a woman might be a whore because she slept with some men never sat well with me. But yet that was a notion growing up that was handed down to us, you know. It was trying to make sense out of that. Why can men do it and women cannot do it? It's in this area. Some night if you want to have a drink, we can sit down and talk about it.
Right.
The one thing that might interest you that I learned from the pimp in terms of treating one of his girls was he said to me, when you say to one of your girls that you love her, you mean it. I said to him, you mean that you want her to understand that you mean it? He said, no, you mean it. You do love her. And you do want to take care of her. That was an answer that provoked many questions in my own soul about relationships.
You know the scene in Taxi Driver where you're dancing with Jodie Foster and you're giving her the rap?
Yes.
Telling her how beautiful she is and how much you care for her?
Yes.
Did that come out of improvising with this pimp?
Yes, the entire scene did. And I wrote the song along with one of the producers at that time.
So is this the kind of rap that the pimp would also often use on the women who work for him?
Yes. I got it from him. I just wrote the song along with this other fellow. It was just basically simple, you know. I took the idea from a Barry White song.
Oh, that's really interesting because I always think of that scene when I hear a certain kind of Barry White song.
Yes, right. Well, that's where I got the idea from.
Which particular song was it?
There was no particular song, just his style.
I don't like what I'm doing, Swartz.
Oh, baby, I never want you to like what you're doing. If you ever liked what you were doing, you wouldn't be my woman.
You never spend any time with me anymore.
Well, I got to attend to business, baby. You miss your man, don't you? I don't like to be away from you either. You know how I feel about you. I depend on you. I'd be lost without you. Don't you ever forget that. How much I need you.
Harvey Keitel in Taxi Driver. We'll talk more with Keitel after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Harvey Keitel. I'm really interested in hearing something about your background. What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
Well, a very colorful neighborhood in Brooklyn called Brighton Beach. I went to school in Coney Island, which was just a couple of blocks walk away. Mixture of Italian, Jewish, black, Irish neighborhood. Coney Island. There was still Mardi Gras going on when I was a kid. I sold confetti at the Mardi Gras as a boy. It was a beautiful place to grow up, really. Very colorful people.
When did you want to start acting, and what made you want to act?
I don't really know when. I couldn't really answer that. I do know it began at some point when I was selling shoes in New York. I'd come out of the Marine Corps, and I was selling shoes part-time, and After some friend I was working with asked me if I wanted to go down and see about acting lessons, I said, okay. He took me to this place, the Anthony Menino Studios in New York, and he left and I stayed.
What did you like about it?
I guess I had this need to paint the cave wall with my pictures.
Huh. What did your friends think about acting? Did they think it was macho enough?
Oh, they made fun of me, ridiculed me, embarrassed me, those rats, but I got even. No, they were a wonderful group of people I grew up with, you know, but acting, the idea of someone being an actor was so far from where they were at that they had to mock it, you know. But they all, of course, love my success and are very proud themselves of it.
Did you try to ever hide your acting from them so that they wouldn't make fun of you?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. At first, I think I told them I was going to do it. Then when they all laughed so hard, I began to hide it.
So you'd go to acting classes and not tell them?
Right, and this one guy, Morty Cohn, gave me a nickname. He started to call me Hollywood. I'm going back many years, you know. And here I am talking to you now from Hollywood.
Right. And I'm sure they go to see all your movies.
Oh, yes, yes, sure.
I want to get back very briefly to the role of sport when you played the pimp and Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Had you ever seen yourself that transformed before?
No, I think that was the... That for me was a step into an area I had not been before, which was I began to provoke myself. I became bolder. My own creativity had taken a bolder step at that point. I became less afraid to use my imagination.
You know, it's interesting. Not many actors would go from the leading man role in Mean Streets to playing a role like a pimp in the next movie.
Well, because leading men don't interest me. What interests me is to know things, is to understand things, is to be, to exist. That's what interests me. It could be one line in a movie. It could be no lines. My identity does not hinge on the size of the role. My identity hinges on the quality of the creation, of the quality of the struggle. And the very fact that I do struggle is the success.
Your first few movies were with Martin Scorsese, who's one of the master directors in America, one of our best. Were you disappointed afterwards working with other directors? Did you think that movies would always be like they were with Scorsese and find out that they weren't?
Well, I couldn't say no to that question. Yes, there were times I was disappointed, but more by, I suppose, the people than by their talent sometimes. Although I'm really being very, very picky here because I've really worked with some brilliant people. I've been very lucky in that regard, you know. I've been very lucky. But, yes, there were times it was Marty's enthusiasm, Marty's spirit, Marty's thing that was so exciting. And at the few times I was not around that thing, you know, that desire he has for getting at what is deep, for getting at what is passionate, yes, it became less interesting for me. Also, he's very good to work with for an actor because he's so giving to the actor. He needs and wants the actor to give him everything that they've got. And to do that, the director has to set the environment for the actor. And Marty does that very well. A lot of directors are afraid to let the actors create and offer what they have to. Marty is very open to that. As part of his brilliance is that, setting an environment in which to work.
Harvey Keitel recorded last year. He spoke with us from a Los Angeles hotel room where he was preparing for a flight to New Zealand to shoot a movie with director Jane Campion. That movie, The Piano, will be shown next month at the New York Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is back from Israel, where he's been reporting on reaction to the Israeli PLO peace agreement. Robert, what will you have tonight on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from Scott Simon, who was down in Gaza today. We'll also be talking with a Syrian journalist and researcher in London about what Syria's interests are at this point. On other matters, we'll be hearing from a woman who is now suffering the early stages of Alzheimer's, early enough that she's able to describe the experience, which she does to Linda Wertheimer. And Brenda Wilson, with a special report on the relationship between a teenage boy and his 35-year-old mentor in New Haven, Connecticut. The boy was getting into a lot of trouble, and his mentor knew about that story from his own childhood.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Maybe the last thing followers of director Martin Scorsese would have expected after Goodfellas and Cape Fear was an adaptation of The Age of Innocence, Edith Wharton's classic novel about late 19th century New York society. And when the movie was delayed from a 1992 release until now, inquiring minds wanted to know whether Scorsese had gotten in over his head. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to find out.
If this is what Scorsese is like when he's in over his head, I suggest that he dunk himself regularly. The Age of Innocence is a heartbreakingly beautiful romance that is also virile and innovative and cinematically alive. It's a real Edith Wharton movie and a real Scorsese movie at the same time. And like so many of Scorsese's films, it's about the redemption that comes through suffering. What you might have doubted was that Scorsese could capture the tone of 1870s New York, not just the costumes and decor, but the way people walked and talked and gestured. You can lay that worry to rest right away. The sense of authenticity in this movie is breathtaking, from the flowers that Scorsese turns into a symbol of the film's rising and falling passions to the way the food is arranged on the French china. But then you might expect that with all that meticulousness, Scorsese would lose the thrusting camera movement that's the hallmark of his style. You'd be wrong. Scorsese's camera glides through The Age of Innocence like one of the dancers in its ballrooms. And it's not just moving for the sake of movement. When the film's hero, a young lawyer named Newland Archer, strolls into a room, the camera takes on his gait and stops to peer at a painting with an archer-like cock of the head. It doesn't just photograph the painting, it peruses it. Archer's played by Daniel Day-Lewis. He's just announced his engagement to the equally well-born and conventional Mae Welland, played by Winona Ryder. But now Mae's cousin has returned to New York. She's the fascinating Ellen Olenska, played by Michelle Pfeiffer. And her European past is shrouded in scandal, so that much of New York society considers her persona non grata. Still, she does manage to show up at least one party where she engages Archer in insinuating conversation.
May I tell you what most interests me about New York? Not all the blind obeying of tradition, somebody else's tradition. It seems stupid to have discovered America only to make it a copy of another country. Do you suppose Christopher Columbus would have taken all that trouble just to go to the opera with Larry Lefferts?
Well, I think if you'd suspected that Lefferts were here, the Santa Maria might never have left port.
And May, does she share these views?
Or if she does, she'd never say so.
Are you very much in love with her?
As much as a man can be.
Do you think there's a limit?
If there is, I haven't found it.
Sable. It's really and truly a romance, then. Not in the least arranged.
Have you forgotten in our country we don't allow our marriages to be arranged?
Yes, I forgot. I'm sorry. I sometimes make these mistakes. I don't always remember that everything here is good. That was bad where I came from.
You don't need to have read the book to know that this is the beginning of an illicit romance. Scorsese and his co-writer Jay Cox have woven a screenplay in which what isn't said is almost as important as what is. And the acting conveys what the words don't. As Archer, Daniel Day-Lewis gives a performance that unfolds like one of the movie's bouquets, from repression to ardor to overwhelming loss. As his fiancée, Winona Ryder is the perfect innocent with a will of steel. And Michelle Pfeiffer is all you could want as Ellen Olenska. She makes the character's very forthrightness and honesty seem provocative, which in this rigid society it is. Scorsese has adapted a masterpiece without a hint of masterpiece theater. The movie isn't for a moment stuffy or sluggish. It's full-blooded and passionate and genuinely sad. And certainly, so far, the best movie of the year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Fred Landerl. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Devin Reif is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a profile of Yasser Arafat. We talk with Andrew Gowers, author of Behind the Myth, Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Revolution. Gowers is a former Middle East editor at the Financial Times in London. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.